The following is Voices of Experience radio show and podcast. No promotional fees are paid by authors or other guests who appear on the show. If you have comments or suggestions, call the Voices of Experience hotline at 425-653-1166. That's 425-653-1166.
Welcome to Voices of Experience. My name is Paul Casey, and we have Eric Crema in the studio back today. And of course, Eric Ryder is with us working the boards, as he always does. And it's great to be back in the studio today, I must admit.
Yeah, you've been doing it in person.
Yeah, been doing in the Zoom calls. I wonder if the audience can tell it's Zoom versus live like this.
Probably. Yeah, I would think so. I just like it better when you're in the studio, get to see you, but also it's just easier to communicate when we're, you know, 5 feet away from each other. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is good to be back here, and this is, well, we're coming on the last couple of shows of this quarter, and we're going to take about 3 weeks off and play some repeat shows or encore shows, whatever you call it, and we'll be back coming up very shortly with some more great programming. Speaking of that, today, we have a Jack Kavanaugh. He wrote a book called Always Ireland, National Geographic, and I perused the book, and I do talk about a number of books, but this is really one of the most beautiful books with the scenery and the content in it. That's all I can say. And the big thing is, I think if you are going to plan a trip to Ireland, you should listen to this interview at a minimum, because he gives some great tips on what you should do. For example, if you are going there for a week or so, well, you shouldn't try to see the whole country, even though it looks small. We're going to talk to him in a few moments, so we'll let him tell us. But
that's
anyhow,
great.
He's a really fascinating individual. He actually is of Irish descent. He grew up there, and then he moved to America, and he's got dual citizenships. But anyhow, that's going to be extremely interesting. I was there one time, and I picked up a lot of great tips from him.
Great.
Maura McDonald, I had her on the program maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and she's the environmental program director of the Walton family, and it's a foundation, and we talk about water, and we were talking about water then, and what's the situation now. We have new terms in our dialogue now, like atmospheric river, that I don't even think existed 3 or 4 years ago, but I asked about some of those impacts now and how she feels about that. But again, we're still in a very tough time in terms of our water. If you look like an article last week about the Great Salt Lake, I mean, that's really serious and real serious trouble. Mountain climber Jim Whittaker. I don't know how many people have heard that name, but I'm sure most people have.
Pretty famous.
Yeah, and he was the first American to climb Mount Everest in 1963. And, of course, he started REI, he and his brother. Grew up in West Seattle, which is where I'm at, and he now lives in Port Townsend, and I think he's into his early 90s right now, but going strong. This interview I had with him was in the late 1990s about his adventure to Mount Everest, and so it's great to pull it out of the archives again. I listened to it, and the reason he's such a good interview is that he just is so candid, and he doesn't have this huge ego, like what he's trying to do, and he's got a really good sense of humor. So I'm glad to be able to bring that one back.
Well, once you've climbed Mount Everest, you know, you're like, mic drop. You know, mic drop time.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean,
you don't have to brag about anything. You've done something pretty substantial.
Yeah, what did you do? I'm Mount Everest.
Yeah, I work in a cubicle.
Right. No, it is. It's amazing. Voices in history today. Eric, you got it, but I'm going to plant the seed.
We'll see what Eric has to say as well.
Gets it. But a U.S. Secretary of State made an acquisition of land for 2 cents an acre. And at the time, he was ridiculed for spending all this money. But I think in hindsight, it looks like a pretty good investment.
Did they say it was a folly, perchance?
You too. You both got it.
So don't give the front half of that.
Right. No, I mean, I'm not gonna.
Probably everybody has it now, but that's okay. I didn't know that folly statement until I read it. You guys both picked that up. So, well, timeless classic. Let's see if I can fool you both on this one. It was written and sung by an artist that I am positive that 100% of the audience will know his name.
Okay, good clue.
Yes, and he felt that the girl he was dating at the time in the 1960s was not paying enough attention to him, and so he wrote this song, and it was on Rubber Soul. But that's it. That's all the hints I'm going to give.
I'm
going
to defer to the other Eric on this one. He's the musical genius.
That's true.
Well, I know what it is because you told me, but this is a song by this group that I'd never heard before. So, you know, learning something new.
Okay.
There we go.
Well, that's you always learn something new. Huh? Speaking of something new, and that is the concert that you went to on Saturday night. We had an interview last week.
Yeah,
with, Marie Osmond. First of all, I want to know, Eric, what was the concert like? And secondly, what was it like meeting her?
So the concert was great, about three quarters full. It's a big concert area. I'd not been to, or I should say event center, I had not been to the Muckleshoot Casino ever before. And I've been to pretty much every other casino in the area, so it surprised me that I hadn't been there. I was really surprised at the facility. Very nice, easy to get in and out of. Very well organized and run. I spoke to a gentleman named Bob in their box office. He heads up that area in that department. And he did a great job ensuring that our contest winners, if you remember, we did a contest last week.
Sure did.
And the response was huge. People, I mean, the phones just lit up and people wanted to go. And I talked to each and every one of those winners to confirm. And they were so excited. So I hope they did make it. There were too many people there for me to kind of see. You know, I don't know what they look like, obviously, so I didn't meet them. But I hope they did the concert because it was a little bit of nostalgia. I was so impressed, though, with her operatic singing. Amazing voice. Apparently, she can sing 4-octave. So, and she showed that off. I mean, she's got the pipes still, and she works with the crowd. I love artists who kind of get to know the crowd a little bit and make them a bit of the show. She brought one guy up and sang kind of a love song to him, and he was blushing. It was pretty funny. She had him engaged in the song too and ended up giving him some prizes. You know, just had a real casual, kind of someone like you feel like you would know, like a friend or something, you know. So she does a great show. And then meeting her afterward was just amazing. She was just like she was in the interview last week in terms of put you right away at ease. She wanted us, I was there with my wife, and she had her nephew. He was sort of singing Sinatra-style songs during the concert.
Okay.
And he had overcome MS. And so she was talking about that. And we have a photo of the four of us kind of arm in arm, and she insisted that we go arm in arm. So it was just... It was a very pleasant evening, and I'll tell you, Muckleshoot Casino is super easy to get to. We were there, and we live all the way in Port Orchard, and we were there, and oh my goodness, it was like 40 minutes was all. It was great. It was a memorable evening, and having kind of grown up watching her as a kid, I was really excited to meet her, so there was a little bit of starstruck for me, but I want to thank the folks down there. They did a great job.
Well, good to hear. I really enjoyed the interview with her.
Thank you.
And so glad that you enjoyed yourself.
Yeah, had a
you
great
also
time.
Have something else going on, Eric, and that is a survey that's going on of the audience, KKNW. Of course, if you're listening to the show on Kixi, we also broadcast a show on sister station KKNW.
And you have for many years. So I know there's some crossover audience. And so we did want to mention this, that if you go to our website and log on, you'll see the survey there. And if you like the show, we would love for you to comment on it. Take the survey. It helps us frame that station in certain ways. And if you're a fan of Voices of Experience, whether it be on Kixi, KKNW, or podcast, make sure you're checking out our website, KKNW 1150KKNW.com, 1150KKNW.com. There I am screwing it up for everybody. But go on there. It's the first thing you'll see. Super easy. And we're giving away a trip for two to round trip up to Victoria and the Victoria Clipper, plus some great restaurant script too, to go out and have a dinner. And so one lucky winner is going to get that. It takes all of about 5-10 minutes, and it really does help us out. We want to hear your thoughts.
Sure, that's always very helpful. I mean, we've done that on the air sometimes, and people will call in and say, hey, we want to hear more of this, and like on older workers and looking for jobs. Well, we've implemented that, and we're going to be spending more time on that. So we do listen.
And the biggest part of that survey is the dog and cat war. Every year, Eric and I look at it, and we got to figure out, okay, place your bets. What's going to be the tally? Is it more people have cats in their house or more people have dogs in their house? And it goes back and forth. It's kind of fun.
Really?
Yep.
Interesting.
Kooks and dog rivalry. What does that remind me of?
I wouldn't know what you're talking about. I have to scratch my head on that. Go Cougs. Anyhow, we'll go now in a few moments to the interview with Jack Kavanaugh coming up in just a moment.
If you're thinking about going to Ireland, I have just the person to help guide you to whatever areas of the island that you are thinking of visiting. His name is Jack Kavanaugh. He grew up in Ireland and has led tours back to his homeland. He's written a book that has been published by National Geographic. It is filled with incredible backstories and photos. Jack, you were born in Ireland, then came to the United States. What was your trajectory? Why did you do that?
Well, work, really. I wanted to be a journalist, and I was working for a Dublin paper called the Irish Press, a very long-established paper. But it was on its way down, and I had a feeling it was about to go out of business, and it was proved right a year later. So I came over in 1994 for the World Cup. I did a bit of sports reporting. I came over for the Soccer World Cup in America in 1994. And I looked around, and I found a job in the Philadelphia region. I came back the following year, took up the job, thinking, I'll give it a year, see what happens. And here I am, I think, 27 or 28 years later.
And so when did you get into the tour business?
Well, that came about because I've been working for National Geographic since 2001 in various guises. I've been an editor for international editions, and then I worked for books. I was an editor of tour guides. The National Geographic has a wing called the National Geographic Expeditions, and they send various experts, as we're called, around with the groups who give lectures and introduce people to the culture and the country. So they came to me and they said, would you like to go to Ireland for a 10-day tour and stay in all these lovely hotels and talk to people about Ireland? And I said yes, and it's wonderful. It's a great, great way to see my homeland again, you know?
Oh, of course. That's a nice luxury to have. Let's get into, let's say, people going to Ireland. And let's say someone has a week to go to Ireland. That's all they have. They want to see it for the first time. Where would you suggest they go?
Well, I always say to people going to Ireland is don't overschedule it, because you'll miss the real joy of Ireland, which is the people. The people are the real treasure of Ireland. People love to talk in Ireland, and people are very open and interested about other people. They'll give you the time to talk. So if you're rushing around from one place to the other and seeing all these places, you miss out on, you know, what makes Ireland special, which is the people and its culture, and just that warm feeling of, you know, being with people who have time to talk. And I really think that you shouldn't try and do too much. But if you have a week, maybe go to Dublin, maybe go to Galway, and pick one other place, maybe Kerry, but Kerry is kind of distant, so maybe somewhere like Kilkenny. Kilkenny's a lovely medieval town. It's got fabulous nightlife. It's got a beautiful medieval museum, one of the best in the world now, in St. Mary's Church, and they operate the medieval mile walking tours where you see the whole of Kilkenny. Really lovely place to spend a couple of days, and it's all very local, so you can walk everywhere. But really, Paul, I'd say don't try and do too much. Just enjoy every day in Ireland, you know, and be relaxed about it.
I couldn't agree more. Actually, I did go to Ireland in 1989. My ancestry goes back to Boyle, Roscommon, and we actually good to hear. And, you know, we went there, we landed in Shannon, but we had a person who went to Ireland in advance and said what you said. We had a week, and he said, keep it close to the vest. And you are so right. We were able to see a lot of the Irish people, and it's everything you say, that they want to talk, and talk, and they're proud of their country, and you learn so much. Now, how about, let's say, you have a month to go. What would you suggest then?
Well, obviously, go to all the big places like Dublin. Go to Kerry. Kerry's great if you have the time to explore. It's a vast county in the southwest of Ireland on the Atlantic. Absolutely beautiful hills, really scenic places. A lovely town called Dingle. You can go and explore. It's a very rich cultural place. There's a marvelous place called the Dishcart Centre of Spirituality in Dingle, which has, it's a real little hidden gem. It's got 12 stained glass windows by Harry Clarke, a famous Irish artist. And you can walk in there and just make a little contribution to the convent. It's in a convent, and see these glorious works of art. Right across the street, you've got what I call the 10 most musical square feet in Ireland, which is the Dingle Record Shop. You can have a long chat about music because they know everything about music in there, and they're happy to share it with you. I spent like hours in there researching this book. You can go up to Clare, Doolin, tiny little village, four pubs, but it's the home of traditional Irish music, and all those pubs will be hopping every night with a lovely music session. Go to Galway, explore Galway, which is, I call Galway the heart of Ireland because it's the Gaelic heart of Ireland. You know, they speak Irish in that region, the Gaeltacht region. Galway is such a vibrant city for the arts. There's always a festival going on. There's the Galway Races. There's the International Arts Festival. There's a Guinness and Oyster Festival in October, and I think in April there's a poetry festival. There's always something happening in Galway, a lovely place. And then if you have the time, go up to Donegal, which I kind of rediscovered doing this book, and it's a gem. It's a little bit distant, and it's harder to get through than the rest of the country because there's only one road going from the Republic. But it's well worth the time to get up there. I was describing to a friend of mine, and I said it's like the Louisiana of Ireland in that it kind of marches to its own drum, you know. The music is a little bit different. The fabulous, rich culture of music singing up there. And there's all kind of surprising things that you come across. Like I came across this place called Wild Ireland, which is a wildlife refuge. And the man up there is this passionate lawyer, Killian McLaughlin, and he's trying to recreate the Celtic rainforest of thousands of years ago by reintroducing all these animals that have gone extinct, like the wolf, the bear, birds, etc. But magical day I had it at Wild Ireland. Oh, I could go on. Belfast, there's so much to do. Ireland is really, really, you know, it's a fascinating place because there's so much going on in such a small area that if you have a month, you're in for the best month of your life, you know.
That's good to hear. I'm going to talk about your book in a moment, or I'll talk about it right now, actually. Always Ireland. It's one of the finest publications I've seen pulled together ever. I mean,
oh, thank you.
The photographs, I think there are over 300, are incredible. And just the history and the detail that you go into is absolutely wonderful. I just know so much more about it. I mean, you even get into Irish history, the insider history tips to kind of make you feel you're learning something that you didn't know before. When people visit and go on your tours, what surprises them most about Ireland that they didn't know?
A few things. They're surprised how we like satire. Satire is big in Ireland, and that sense of irony and kind of dark humor. And that kind of comes about, I think, from history, and we go into this in the book, that it's a kind of subversive way of having a go at authority. Irish people are pretty irreverent, you know, when it comes to authority and government and all this kind of thing. So we go into the history of that in the book, and I talk to my guests on the tour, and they're always kind of warm to this theme for some reason. They kind of like this Irish subversiveness of irreverence towards authority. It brings out the Irish in people, I think, you know. The other thing they're surprised with is how small the country is. You know, we're only like 5.4 million people. I tell the story, Paul, that I was in D.C. a few years ago when I worked there, and I was at a bus stop, and I was reading a book by Colm Tobin, Irish novelist, and I felt this presence over my shoulder, a guy trying to see what the book was. So I fell into conversation with him, and he was asking me all the right questions about Ireland, and then he said, how many people are there in Ireland, you know? And I said, well, at the last count, I said there was 4.5 million at the last census. And he looked at me in amazement, and he said, what? He said, for 4.5 million people, you guys make a hell of a racket, you know? And that's true. Like, he was talking culturally about, you know, the amount of literature that's come out of Ireland and the music and whatnot. But I think that surprises people, you know, that it's such a tiny country, really.
I didn't know that before I went as well, and I was surprised. I mean, it's not, it doesn't have the population, about half of the state of Washington. So it is quite amazing that there's so little numbers of people. What do you think the biggest myth...
The other side of the equation, Paul, is that there's 20 million of us abroad, and we do get into that in the book, you know, the Irish abroad and the stamp they've had on the world. So we go into the Irish in America, the Irish in Europe, etc., you know.
Are there people moving there quite a bit now?
There's been a huge uptick in applications for passports, partly because of Brexit, of course. People wanted a European passport, and there's a whole lot of Irish people, of course, living in Britain for years. You know, I have, I think, six people in my family, six cousins of mine are married to English people and living in Britain. So, you know, that causes all kinds of complications when they want to go to France for their holidays or whatever. They have to, they have all these problems they didn't have 3 years ago, whatever, 4 years ago, whenever it was. But I think a lot of people are just saying, you know, Ireland is a great place now, and it's come a long way in terms of economics and that. A lot of people want to retire there, myself included, you know.
We just celebrated St. Patrick's Day. What is the biggest myth about that event?
There's lots of myths about it. The one thing that mystifies me, I must say, is the green beer thing. You know, I can never understand that. I always compare it. I tease my American friends here and I say, look, you know, do you dye your turkey red, white, and blue and eat it on Thanksgiving? Because that's what you're doing to the beer. You know, we're just joking. But there's a lot in the book about St. Patrick and who he was. And I think one surprising thing that a lot of people don't realize is that St. Patrick was an immigrant. He wasn't Irish. He was a slave actually brought over from Britain, you know. And I think that's a very relevant thing to remember in this day and age when, you know, when there's such a big problem with immigrants and people moving all around the world. You know, Patrick was one of those. He was a human slave who was traded, basically, you know.
Anything else before we go, Jack?
No, I just encourage everyone to go to Ireland once because, as I said, it's a great place for people. People love to talk in Ireland, and you'll be very, very welcome there.
I'm inspired. I want to go back.
Lovely. Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.
My thanks to Jack Kavanaugh. The book he wrote is Always Ireland. And to get a copy, all you need to do is Google Always Ireland.
You just received some startling news. You're going to need brain surgery. But the doctor also says your prospects for total recovery are excellent. The doctor is very confident with his prognosis. He's performed hundreds of similar surgeries during his career. Who would you choose? This doctor or another doctor who's never performed this type of surgery? If the doctor who's performed similar surgeries is your choice, then experience is important to you. That's what Voices of Experience with Paul Casey is all about. People with experience in their chosen fields. Topics explored including public affairs, self-employment, travel, health and fitness, history, and adventure.
Welcome to this edition to Voices of Experience. My name is Paul Casey.
Voices of Experience is simulcast on AM 880 KIXI and 1150 AM KKNW on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Voices of Experience is also rebroadcast on KIXI Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. Visit voicesofexperience.com and take a 5-minute self-employment quiz. The higher you score on the quiz, the higher your prospects for success. That's voicesofexperience.com.
Certainly enjoyed talking to Jack Kavanaugh about Ireland and inspired me, as I said at the end of the interview, to go. And we've been talking about that in the studio here, and let's do it.
Let's go to Ireland. Let's go to Ireland. Let's do the show from Ireland. How does that sound?
I'm on board.
Fun. All right, let's do it.
Yeah, there we go.
So who's their main carrier? Who's the big airline that goes there from here?
Aer Lingus.
What is it?
Aer Lingus?
Aer Lingus, yeah.
So if they're listening, the CEO of Aer Lingus, I'm sure, listens to this program.
Oh, I'm sure he does, too.
And we'll be happy to mention the airline.
First class seats any moment. I'm sure he's going to call in any moment and just say, you guys are on. Speaking of another show and what's going on, we talked about the Moisture Festival last week, and that's still going on until April 16th. Do have four tickets available two tickets apiece, let's just say, for a show on Wednesday, April 5th at 7:30 p.m. And so the first callers to call in, they get the tickets. That's 425-653-1166, 425-653-1166. You need to answer any questions. If you call in, they will be yours. We just gave some tickets away last week. I'm going to have the individual who's attending tonight to talk about what he saw about the Moisture Festival. And one of the reasons he called in so quickly, he has been there before and he loved it. And that's why he was so pleased to be going back to this. And
First two callers, yes. Gotcha.
And Broadway Performance Hall on Capitol Hill, that's where it takes place. And that's adjacent to Seattle Central College. And that's literally on the corner of Broadway and East Pine on Capitol Hill. So now we move to Voices in History, this segment, for starting, I guess, on March 29th, and that would be today. This happened in 1980. A 19-year-old North Carolina freshman by the name of Michael Jordan makes a 16-foot jump shot with 15 seconds to give the Tar Heels a 63-62 win over Georgetown for the NCAA Tournament Championship. Jordan tells reporters in New Orleans afterwards, "I didn't see it go in. I didn't want to look." But I thought that was a kind of an interesting one. We're in the midst of the March Madness now, and you can't see a better sporting event ever put together this March Madness.
I mean,
every game practically is just right down to the last shot. And, you know, you get these teams that win games unexpectedly. San Diego State is in the Final Four. Who would have guessed that? That's why it's so much fun.
Yes.
And that's why I wanted to do that. So, again, that was 1980, March 29th. On March 29th, 1958, Dr. Charles David Keeling begins to measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for the first time. He did it from a Hawaiian observatory, and this becomes known as the Keeling curve. Mm. A graph clearly shows the rapid accumulation in the atmosphere of carbon dioxide. So that was in 1958. On March 30th, 1867, you guys got this. U.S. Secretary of State William Seward signed a treaty with Russia for the purchase of Alaska, a purchase of the state for $7 million. Now, despite the price of roughly 2 cents an acre, the purchase was ridiculed in Congress and in the press. It was referred to as
Seward's folly.
You got it.
In stereo.
Wow. There you go. I did not know that. That's a Johnny Carson. I did not know that. March 31st, 1974, John Denver had his first number one hit song, Sunshine on My Shoulders.
Ah, big hit.
Yep. And then on March 31st, 1889, the Eiffel Tower is dedicated in Paris. Didn't know this. The tower was built in honor of the French Revolution.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
See, there you go.
Well, going back to the purchase of Alaska, that's a couple of homes on Mercer Island. You realize that?
Wow.
Exactly. A couple of homes. It could be one.
It could be one. One on the lake.
I mean, heck, I just saw in Puget Sound Business Journal a home that's on the shores of Lake Washington, $85 million.
Oh, geez, I'm out of touch. Okay.
So, yeah, there you go. That's seven Alaskas.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And just one more. This comes from HistoryLink. That's in the state of Washington, a nonprofit. A century ago, marriages between men and women of different races were banned by many states, including California. This guy by the name of J.R. Oakey, who was white, and Gladys Emery, who was black, fell in love, and they eloped to Seattle, where it was legal to get married at that time, and they tied the knot on March 27th, 1909, at the Trinity Parish Church.
Love it. Love that kind of story. That's cool.
Wow. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So we'll be back with an interview and just another interview in just a moment. And I think you'll find this one fascinating because we're talking water. So Maura McDonald joined me just a few weeks ago, and she's the environmental program director for the Walton Family Foundation. Now, we all know about these extreme weather events we've been going and talking about and living through. The atmospheric river, I think I said at the beginning of the show, we didn't even know that term, I think, when I did my last interview with her about this subject in water. And I just wanted to pick up and talk to her again as to where she thinks we're at now as compared to the time that we talked before.
I had an interview with you several years ago about water, the scarcity of it, and the concerns that you have and a lot of people on this planet do. Do you feel we're in a better position in recognizing the crisis we have, or are we in denial?
Well, I don't know that we've made the changes that we need to address the crisis, but I do think that things like what's going on this spring in California with those crazy atmospheric rivers are bringing more attention to our issues. And it's bringing more attention to the need to, in particular, farmers in California are raising this issue around how we need to better protect water in the agricultural context. And, you know, what's kind of great about that is that at the Walton Family Foundation, we really spend our time at right in that space, in that nexus around water, food, and climate. And what's at that center is agriculture. And the reason that we spend our time there is that agriculture is both the biggest polluter and the biggest user of water worldwide. So when we think about how we protect our water for the long term and how we protect our oceans and our rivers and our streams and our lakes and our drinking water, we need to think about how we can change our agricultural practices to make them more sustainable.
One of my questions is, with all the atmospheric rivers coming through California, how can we capture this water coming in?
You know, that's a great question, and I do think people are starting to broach that question, and we think about it as, you know, it's an agricultural problem, right? Because most of our land, you know, a huge percentage of our land is used for agriculture. So we think about how we can change agricultural practices that allow us to take better care of our soil, so that we can have more water infiltrate.
What would some of those be that we can do?
One of the big ones is cover crops. These are crops that we can grow after we harvest our regular crop in the fall, before we plant our next crop in the spring. And they green up really quickly, and they put roots in the ground, and they hold our soil in place. They improve our soil structure. They improve the infiltration capacity of our soil, so that when the spring comes and you have these intense storms, not only do you not have your soil float away with the water into the stream, which pollutes the stream, and, you know, farmers don't want to lose their valuable topsoil. That's their resource that they use for their business to grow their crop. But those cover crops also increase our organic matter in our soil. They make it squishier over time so it can absorb more water, and it can then filter that water out slowly over time and make it available for the crop. So that's one great way that we could be taking better advantage of changing our agricultural practices to better capture our water, but also better treat our water for the long term. The other way is that, and this is what they're talking about in California, is how do we make more space for our rivers so that when our rivers overflow, they actually can overflow onto floodplains where naturally water can seep in slowly and recharge our groundwater and be then accessible for cities and for farmers for a longer term. And that's like, it's not an easy proposition, but it is doable. And it's something that people around the world have begun to think about, how we can make more space for water.
Is there resistance to this, or is it just about education?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that there's increasingly interest in how we can better manage our agricultural practices to protect our water. But, you know, sometimes it costs money. And so that's one of the things that we do at the Walton Family Foundation is we develop partnerships. We work with farmers and communities, downstream communities that drink the water. We work with food companies, and we work with governments to help put together projects that help introduce farmers to new practices and help support them during that transition. You know, there's a myriad of farmer styles and farms that operate in different ways. So, like, really understanding the unique conditions of the farm and what they need to take on and make that transition to conservation agriculture, it's just different for each one. So we need to find ways to develop the partnerships to provide the right support to meet them where they're at.
Are you optimistic we'll be able to do that?
I am optimistic that we'll be able to do that. And I'm optimistic that that water is such an important issue, and that, you know, as people understand more about water and its growing scarcity and its importance for our food supply and for people to be healthy, that people will take more care of their water, and they'll think of themselves more as like, oh, I'm here in this watershed, and I know my water comes from this place nearby, and I want to do everything I can to protect it. I think that that's the hope for the long term.
I read in information that was sent out before this interview that 2 billion people in the world are living without access to water. That's pretty stunning. How can 2 billion people survive without access to water?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about people who don't have access to water in their homes, so they don't have indoor plumbing. And there's actually a surprisingly large number of people that don't have access to water in their homes, even in this country. And that was a huge challenge during the pandemic, when people needed to be able to access water to stop the spread of COVID, to wash their hands more, to have more, to up their hand washing and their hygiene. There's more resources now. That issue really came to light. There's more resources now to help more people access water. But at the end of the day, with agriculture being such a big water user, making sure there's enough water for people and enough fresh, clean water for people really does come back to us figuring out how we help farmers change their practices.
Anything else before we go?
I would just say that, you know, Morning Consult did that great poll, and they found that, you know, a lot of people really support this idea of improving our agricultural practices to protect our water. I think they looked at voters, and they found 76% supported helping farmers to make that transition to protect our land, our water, and our health.
Our thanks to Maura McDonald, the Environmental Program Director for the Walton Family Foundation, for, you know, really filling us in and really the most important resource on our planet, and that is water. So we'll keep in touch with her from time to time, and as we talked about, I've spent time in California, and certainly a big dent was made in the drought that's down there. As a matter of fact, I think the governor has lifted some restrictions there, but to think we have this problem solved, and I don't think anybody out there believes that we've solved it any close to that, but we definitely need to pay much more attention to water conservation. So glad that she was able to meet with us. And again, I just want to put out there that if you want to go to the Moisture Festival, we interviewed Ron Bailey last week about, and he's the founder of that. We have sets of two tickets available for two people. Just call the Voices of Experience hotline at 425-653-1166, and you will get those two tickets for the show, which is going to be on Wednesday, April 5th, 7:30 p.m., and a week from today. So there you go. Now, on to an interview that I have. I will tee it up right at this moment in kind of my introduction. I did, about 20-some-odd years ago, my interview with Jim Whitaker.
Legendary mountain climber and Northwesterner Jim Whitaker is with us today. When did you first know that you wanted to climb mountains?
A Boy Scout back there in 72 in West Seattle, and a long time ago, and we used to take hikes up in the Olympics and Cascades, and the trails led up to the mountains, and so we learned a little bit about scrambling and so forth and get up in some pretty hairy places, and then decided, hey, we better learn something about it. So I joined the Mountaineers Club and began went through the climbing course and so forth. And then 1948, I began to guide up on Mount Rainier, taking people out to the ice caves and up to the summit.
And do you remember like a defining moment when you said, this is what I want to do?
My parents would take me for walks down to the beach there and Fauntleroy and so forth, and I would walk from Fauntleroy all the way up to Arbor Heights every day, from home to school and back, and so that this was a sort of a natural extension of it, and everything is so clean. Nature's a good teacher. We, you know, it's wonderful to stand up on top of mountains and to be in the forest, and we've been programmed for centuries to do that, you know, so it's just recently we've been locked up in buildings in these bottles with wheels that go down asphalt trails.
Your parents, were they outdoorsmen, or was this something that you kind of adopted? So they were. They kind of led the way.
Yeah, they sort of led the way. And, you know, the outdoors is all, has been my life.
The climb on Mount Everest in 1963, how did that develop and all come together?
Well, I've been climbing, but guiding on Rainier, and was both my brother and I, Lou, were well known as strong, very strong climbers. And so I got a phone call from Norman Durnford, the Swiss fellow that lived in Santa Monica and had thought about forming an expedition to climb Mount Everest, American expedition. So it was, you know, relatively unclimbed. And, you know, so I got a phone call asking if I'd like to join an American Mount Everest expedition. And, you know, it took me a long time to decide, almost 60 seconds. And I said, sure, and was invited to go along. You know, the whole thing is a series of exciting moments, but I guess the worst was the second day we were climbing on the mountain when we lost one of our team, Jake Breitenbach, who was a guide from Jackson, Wyoming. And they were climbing an ice wall that I had gone up the day before to put route on. There was no other way around it. We had to go up the wall. And Jake was there when the wall collapsed, and it killed him. So we lost one of our team just the second day on the mountain. And that was a pretty tough thing to overcome. Some of the team decided not to do that wall and would stay in base camp and help out, but not climb the mountains. The rest of us thought, well, we could, you know, we had more reason to cut the mountain even because of Jake. So,
what was it like standing on the top of Mount Everest?
I get asked that a lot. And when I crawled out of the high camp at 27,500 feet with Gambu, a Sherpa that I was climbing with, we were battered by 50-mile-an-hour winds, and it was 35 below zero without the wind chill factor. So we started up in storms. No one else moved on the mountain that day. Everyone said it couldn't be climbed in that weather, and the weather was too bad to go out, so they stayed in their tents. But Gambu and I had only enough oxygen to go to the summit or back down to lower camp. So it was my last and only chance to get to the summit of Mount Everest. So we took off and fought our way up. I got some serious frostbite on the face. I was blind in one eye. When we reached the summit, we were out of bottled oxygen. We stood on the summit 20 minutes. And so we started down without bottled oxygen. They asked Gambu at our first press conference in New Delhi, they said, what was the first thing you thought of after having reached the highest point of Earth when you stood there on the summit of summits? And he answered for me as well when he said, how to get down. That was the answer. Yeah.
And that was Jim Whitaker. And he'll be back next week for part two of our interview on U.S. West Profiles of Experience. Legendary mountain climber and Northwesterner Jim Whitaker is with us today on U.S. West Profiles of Experience. Well, let's talk about your newest adventure, and that is a sail around the world. Just want to let the listeners know that you're talking to us from your sailboat. You're preparing it for a trip that's going to leave from Port Townsend on October 15th.
All right, it's a circumnavigation of the planet. We thought we'd take our 11- and 13-year-old boys out and show them a little bit about the world and about what a wonderful place it is if you can just get out in it.
And what's your route going to be?
We'll go down the coast, stop in Santa Cruz. We have friends there, and then go on down into San Diego, wait for the hurricane season to end in Mexico, then go into the Sea of Cortez in Mexico for a few months, then head across into the Marquesas and the South Seas. And then, of course, you go from there to Australia and then up into the Solomons, up into the Bay of India. We plan to leave our boat in Bombay. My friend Gambu, who climbed Everest with me, will have his family that live on board while we go in for a trek to the base of Everest and take my two sons and a few other friends that might want to go. And then we'll come back to the boat and continue up north through Suez Canal and into Mediterranean. And I've got friends in Russia from my peace climb in 1990 on Everest. We'll go see them at Odessa and then going to Norway, Sweden, maybe even touch Greenland, and then come back down the Atlantic coast, Panama Canal, back up California.
And then how long do you project this is going to take?
We talk to people that say, yeah, they started for a year's trip, and they're 9 years later, still into the trip. So we're saying 2 to 3 years on the circumnavigation. But the thing is, if you find a country you know, you're docked into a wonderful country that's, you know, it's nice, and the children learning the language and so forth, and you might stay there a few months. It's hard to say.
Well, I just don't think there's enough adventure in your life.
Well, there's one thing we can give the children. They're not going to take a hell of a lot of money from any big inheritance or anything, but we can give them a sense of belonging to the planet, and it's a beautiful planet, and we want them to enjoy it as much as we have, and adventure is something that we can give the kids. The other thing is that we'll be communicating with children around the country through the eyes of our children, of what we'll have computers on board, so we'll be able to talk on the Internet.
Wonderful.
With the kids, so the kids will be able to tell
fabulous.
When we pull into a village or into a bay or somewhere of some foreign country, and maybe even go to the schools, they can convey what they see.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, you know, taking the advantage of technology and meshing that together incredibly well.
Absolutely. Actually, Microsoft is helping us set up some equipment so we can communicate on almost a weekly basis.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Hey,
and again, best to you.
Okay, same here.
So again, that was an interview I had with Jim Whitaker in the mid to late 1990s. I'm going to say about 1997. And what an incredible individual. And I think I mentioned at the beginning, he's probably in his early 90s right now and living in Port Townsend. And he's been living there for a very, very long time. But what a delight. And as I said in the interview then, that there's just not enough adventure in that guy's life. And you know, he started REI
surfer,
with his brother. And I think they had, from what he told me or read in his book, it was a tough beginning of REI too. And him and his brother had a little collision sometime about it. And they're identical twins, his brother and him. And he was a great mountain climber too. And he led a lot of expeditions to Mount Rainier.
So he lived here locally as well?
Yes. They both grew up in West Seattle.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Now, did you know them when they were younger or just?
No. I was, when he climbed Mount Rainier, I remember I was going to Sacred Heart School in Clyde Hill, and he came with a slideshow about a year later, and I met him there. I'm like 12 and awe of him.
Yeah, I didn't mean you were the same age growing up, like, and you know, you guys were buddies, but I wondered if you'd run into him.
I'm turning 89 next week. You know,
you're looking great. You're looking great.
But he was quite a guy, and it just, not somebody who you'd see that he was in your face a lot. And I do recall, too, I was much more active in politics or thinking about that way, but he was a very close friend of Robert Kennedy's. And he actually brought Robert Kennedy, after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, on a climb in a mountain in Canada that they named Mount Kennedy. So Robert Kennedy wanted to climb it. So he called on Jim Whitaker, who he didn't know at the time, to go on the climb with him. And they became very close friends after that because they were both successful in the climb. And matter of fact, after Robert Kennedy was assassinated, Jim Whitaker was a pallbearer at his funeral. So a little bit more background on how things come together and whatever. But just a very fine individual.
You know, these last few shows have really profiled people's lives, the incredible things they've done. And we've talked in past, like my recent visit to Honolulu and going to Pearl Harbor, and I was lamenting the fact that these young men went from full of life in one moment and then to perish the next day in a horrific attack.
Right.
And I thought to myself, they never got a chance to live their lives. And tragically, in the news, yet another shooting. There was instructors there as well, including the principal that was killed. But those children, 9 years old, who will never see beyond that year, suddenly, you know. And there's so much heartache out there. And I know this is weighing heavily on you, so I wanted to give this time to you.
Yeah, it's just, to me, amazing that we kind of go through the same thing over and over again. What was the definition of insanity, you know?
Right.
Think that you can, you know, change a thing, just happens. And we still continue to look at it that way. And then I kind of got a little frustrated, more than a little, when I see people putting balloons out and candles and vigils and things like that. And I understand the tragedy and trying to do something. But we got to stop doing things like that and start really doing something. And I was just caught by Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, in Ireland. God, we had always Ireland.
No, Israel.
He's running for Prime Minister of Ireland. I'm just kidding. Israel. Anyhow, he tried to do something political that was really unpopular, and what people did was they rose up and went into the streets and said, this isn't going to happen. He's backing off. So all I'm just saying, can't we break this logjam of just gun violence in this country? The hearts, you know, our thoughts and prayers go out. And then again, they're going to have a candlelight ceremony tonight. I get it. But you look at a congressman who's from there who sent out, he's Andy Ogles. He sent out a Christmas card of him and his family with holding these AK-15s, just in your face, the tragedy. And now he says, oh, I'm just really upset about this. And I'm going, you're contributing to this. And the types of people are. So I'm just wanted to get that off my chest because I really do think that we need to step up and do some real serious political action. And I'm really, again, tired of we just accepting this way of life. So I don't know if I'll bring this up again. Maybe if people want to talk about it, I'd be happy to do it. But I guess that's I wanted to make that comment.
And I obviously can hear your frustration. Same here as far as there has to be a solution. And we do have to come together on this. It pains me to think back on my own childhood and just think it was wonderful that way. I mean, I didn't fear this in school. I didn't even fear walking home. I mean, I walked to every single school I went to, sometimes after intramural sports and things like that, so late at night. Didn't have to really worry about that. I mean, this is of course, huge. It's in the news, but there's something going on right now, and we've all got to come together on a solution here.
Really have to wake up.
We were just talking about just how angry people seem out there on all kinds of things. We had four shootings on the highways in the last week and a half.
Yeah.
Because that's, okay, I'm frustrated at you. I'm going to pull out a gun and shoot at you?
Yeah.
Come on.
I had a dinner at a friend's last night and was talking before the show, and it was about him talking about when he was in the First Avenue South Bridge, somebody was trying to get in or he was trying to get in, and they had this thing, and all of a sudden he's staring at a gun right at his face in the car next to him, and he didn't shoot it, but, you know, it's there. So to your point.
It's there, yeah.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Just quote of the week for this week, P.J. O'Rourke, quote, the Democrats are the party that says government will make you smarter, taller, richer, and remove the crabgrass on your lawn. The Republicans are the party who says government doesn't work, and they get elected and prove it. I like that one on both counts, anyhow, to be fair.